From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, Liz Gilbert from Milwaukee 2020 joins us to talk about the impending Democratic National Convention. Then author David Marinus explains that while he is used to doing exhaustive research on his subjects, digging into his own family was much harder.
You know, in other books, biographies of Bill Clinton and Barack Obama and Vince Lombardi, they were strangers to me at the start and became very familiar to me after years of research. In this case, in one sense, my parents were intimately familiar to me at the beginning, and I was afraid that by the end they'd seem like strangers.
Then, as the weather cools down, we look at how the cold can impact our pets. Plus, we learn about the history of Milwaukee County's Oak Leaf Trail.
The idea was to kind of create this series of these hostels in eastern Wisconsin, and that never really took hold, but the idea of having these expansive trails that would have gone along with those did.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. When the DNC announced it would be coming to Milwaukee in 2020, there was a groundswell of excitement mixed with some anxiety. And as the city is inching closer to the event, there is perhaps no one who is feeling that quite like Liz Gilbert. Gilbert is the executive director of the Democratic National Convention's local host committee, Milwaukee 2020. She was profiled in this month's Milwaukee Magazine, and she's here with me in studio. Liz Gilbert, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me.
So you went to UW-Madison, and it's my understanding that you have a degree in elementary education.
That's right.
So how did you end up here in this studio with me talking about the DNC?
So I have always loved working with young kids, and I've wanted to be a teacher my whole life. And so I felt very fortunate that I was able to get into the UW-Madison elementary education program. I was finishing my student teaching just before the President Obama reelection campaign, and as somebody who had interned and organized with the campaigns throughout all of my years in Madison, I wanted to be part of that event. And so I thought I would take a small break from teaching, work on that campaign, and see what came next. And I have bounced around from campaign to convention to other organizations, all in between. And now here I am in Milwaukee with the greatest job.
As you just alluded to, this is not your first rodeo. You've, in fact, worked on the last two DNC planning committees. I'm curious to know what they were like. Paint us a picture. What did that look like?
Absolutely. So I worked on the Charlotte in 2012 host committee, and I was on the fundraising team. I was working on finance operations, and then I was fortunate that I was able to lead the fundraising program in Philadelphia in 2016. Conventions change every 4 years, not just because of the political landscape, though that has a great impact on that, of course. Also, another major impact is where this event takes place. No two cities are alike, but in particular, when you look at Charlotte and Philadelphia and Milwaukee, all incredibly different. But another thing that really changes in between these years is the advancements in technology and digital and other programs that totally change every single 4 years. So I bring that up because no two conventions are alike. And when you look at a convention in Denver in 2008 and Philadelphia in 2016, while there are many similar components, you really take on the flavor of the host community and the flavor of what's going on that year.
Well, and as you look back at Philadelphia, now about 4 years ago, what were some of the big lessons that you learned there?
Yeah, so I think it's really important to make the clarification that the host committee is the civic, nonpartisan, not-for-profit entity that is in charge of hosting and funding the convention. So what we do is community engagement, supplier diversity, equity, inclusion. We are really focused on historic civic engagement efforts. And so when I look back to Philadelphia and I try and make the greatest comparison that I can between my former team and the one that we have here, I'm seeing that we are making incredible strides in doubling down on diversity and inclusion and engagement efforts.
Is that something that you felt was a bit lacking in Philadelphia?
So I think we did a really remarkable job in Philadelphia. But as I just alluded to, every 4 years, the times, they are definitely changing. So the best example is that the Philadelphia Host Committee was the very first to have a director of supplier diversity. So this was nearly 4 years ago. It was the first time that on a DNC convention, we said one person is going to oversee what it means to create a diverse workforce in terms of our vendors and suppliers. So I look at that and say that was an incredible effort, and I'm so happy that we did that. Why stop with one person? So we are the first host committee to have an entire department focused on diversity, equity, and inclusion, because you look at what was done and see what you can do better. And I'm hopeful that 4 years from now, the next host committee expands even greater on what we are doing now.
And when you look at Milwaukee, and I'm not sure about the demographics of Philadelphia, to be quite honest with you, but Milwaukee is a minority-majority city.
Yes.
Are the vendors, are you hoping to have the vendors be reflective of our community here?
Yeah, 100%, and that's a great question. So we will put a significant emphasis on local vendors as well as diverse vendors. And so we are making sure that when we are awarding contracts or stepping into partnerships with businesses, that we are really focused on those businesses that are rooted here and that are trying to grow here. Also, businesses that might not otherwise have the opportunity that this convention, than what this can provide. So, yes, we have an extreme focus on both local and diverse businesses when it comes to our work.
When you say vendors, what does that look like in the context of the convention?
Absolutely. So that is everything from ordering office supplies for the Milwaukee 2020 Host Committee to partnering with a coffee vendor, everything to construction of the stage inside Pfizer for that week. So vendors could be caterers, private security, transportation, you name it. We're really looking for all different types of goods and services. And so we'll be very forward-looking and very open about all of that.
I'm sure the coffee category of that will be hotly contested in a city like Milwaukee.
Absolutely. So we are so thrilled that we entered into a partnership with Shindig Coffee. It's a partnership with Shindig Coffee and Collectivo. For us, it was figuring out what is the best local coffee that we can highlight when we have visitors in our office, and then maybe we'll, you know, circulate through a few others. There were so many to choose from. The coffee here is just amazing. So I agree with you. It is definitely hotly contested, and we'll be getting as many coffee vendors engaged as we possibly can.
Well, and Milwaukeeans know that coffee is a big thing here, but this gets to an issue that I've heard a lot of pundits talk about, specifically in regards to Milwaukee. Unlike Philadelphia, unlike Charlotte even, it seems like the national perspective on Milwaukee is kind of lacking. It's not that they have a bad opinion of the city. It's kind of that they have no opinion.
Yeah, so we actually talk about that a lot. So next summer, we will have 50,000 guests here in Milwaukee. Yes, that is 50,000 guests here next summer. And 15 of that 50 will be members of the International and National Press Corps. And so when we talk about the amount of influence this convention can have on stories and messaging about this town and about this incredible state, the opportunities really are endless. And so for many of the visitors next summer, this will be their first time in Milwaukee or in Wisconsin. And so we, as the host committee, are responsible, and we think it's both a responsibility but also a privilege to be able to shape the perception of all of these visitors and make sure we're getting out the messages that we are looking to highlight on behalf of the city.
When we talk about Milwaukee, certainly internally inside of Wisconsin, there's a big divide between the city and kind of the rest of the state. And when I've seen national coverage in particular, it doesn't seem like people quite understand how Milwaukee lives inside of the state of Wisconsin. Is that something that you're concerned about? Is that something that you're talking about, your team?
Yeah, that's a great question. So for us, even back to the point about local vendors, we are calling local Wisconsin proper, so not just Milwaukee in particular. We want to make sure that folks in Milwaukee, and not even just downtown Milwaukee, but all throughout the city, are finding a way to plug in to and touch this convention. So when you're thinking about how do you get all of Milwaukee's incredible neighborhoods plugged in, you then have to look beyond that and say, well, how are we making sure this is a statewide, year-long effort? And so when we are looking for vendors, when we are looking for venues, and when we are looking for volunteers, we are going to be looking to engage all members of this great state in all three of those categories.
I know a lot of people who want to be involved in the DNC. I know, I think many of our listeners also are probably interested in that. And you guys are looking for volunteers, but what can you expect to be doing there?
Yeah, that's a really good question and something that we are looking forward to elaborating on in these next couple of weeks. So I would say to your listeners and hopefully to everyone who is signing up to engage with us and to participate, stay tuned. We are hoping that before year end, we will have a more robust volunteer platform that isn't just give us your email address and we'll get back to you, which is very helpful. And we're thankful to all of you who have already signed up. But we're going to start asking questions to match people with different volunteer experiences. So we will be looking for folks to, you know, volunteer at events. So let's say the media welcome party, checking tickets, helping with directionals, helping people figure out where to go, being around the city, helping with wayfinding and letting people know when different museums are open or where they should go eat, being at a concierge desk at a hotel and being another friendly face to help make sure people know what to do during the day and how to get there, even being an airport greeter. And so when folks arrive, you are the very first face that they see, and that smile makes an incredible difference on the week-long experience. So the opportunities are really endless, and we're looking forward in the next couple weeks to elaborating on all of those.
There is some concern about a contested convention. What could that mean for Milwaukeeans? A lot of people are already pretty concerned about congestion. You know, one of the big hallmarks of the city is that it's very livable.
Yes.
What would
yes.
a contested convention mean for us?
Yeah, so not that I have lived through one before, so it would be uncharted territory and a new thing for really all of us to experience together. So I, too, look forward to figuring that out alongside all of the other Milwaukeeans that are now my friends and neighbors now that I'm here. But I think what we can expect would just be more people and more press, because the real work of the Democratic Party and these delegates who come here to do the actual work of a nominating convention, we will get to really witness history. So while there will be more people in town, it will become even more historic than what it already is. And so I will be figuring that out alongside hopefully all of these listeners and everyone else in town.
All right. Well, Liz Gilbert, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Liz Gilbert is the executive director of the Democratic National Convention's Local Host Committee, Milwaukee 2020. She was profiled for this month's Milwaukee Magazine, and you can find a link to the article at WUWM.com. Coming up, author David Marinus talks about his newest book titled A Good American Family, The Red Scare and My Father. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. David Marinus usually writes about other people. The Pulitzer Prize-winning author and journalist has penned books about former presidents Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, baseball player Roberto Clemente, and legendary Packers coach Vince Lombardi. His newest book is different and much more personal. Titled A Good American Family, it tells the story of his father, Elliot Marinus, who was brought before the House Un-American Activities Committee in Detroit in 1952. Elliot was questioned for 2 weeks and refused to name names. He was fired from his newspaper job and blacklisted for 5 years. David Marinus was in Milwaukee earlier this year for a literary luncheon at the Milwaukee Public Library. He joined Lake Effect's Bonnie North by phone in May to explain how the Red Scare impacted him and his family.
We were living in Detroit, Michigan. My mother was from Ann Arbor, my father from Brooklyn, but they met at the University of Michigan and then moved to Detroit, where my father was a newspaper man. And in 1952, the House Un-American Activities Committee came to Detroit to hold regional hearings on communism in the Detroit area. There was a star witness at those hearings who later became known as the grandmother spy, who had spent 9 years infiltrating the Communist Party in Michigan. She came in from the cold after those 9 years for these hearings and named hundreds of names. And my father was one of those, and he was sort of collateral damage in those hearings. They were really trying to go after the United Auto Workers Labor Union force in Detroit, which had a strong communist and socialist segment to it. My father had been writing for a communist newspaper in Detroit. He was not a spy. He was not a secret agent. He did not advocate the violent overthrow of the government. He was essentially persecuted for his ideology, for his beliefs. He would later say that he was stubborn in his ignorance about aspects of communism, but he had a strong sense of freedom of speech and freedom of the press and wanted to tell the committee what his vision of being an American was, which was quite different from theirs.
Yeah, I think a lot of people at the time, or looking back on it, realize that they probably had a misunderstanding of what was happening, particularly under Stalin's rule in the Soviet Union. Yeah, but that the idea of, you know, workers' rights was not something that they ever let go of, that was somehow separate, from, as you say, from the ideology. And he was never allowed to actually read his statement, was he?
No, he had a very powerful statement on freedom of speech and freedom of the press, and he wrote it to deliver to the committee. The chairman of the committee, a Georgian who was a Southern racist who voted against every civil rights measure in Congress and for the poll tax and had briefly been a member of the Klan, said that my father could not read the statement unless he was contrite and sought absolution for his sins and named names, which my father refused to do. So the statement was essentially put into the files of the committee and buried there for 63 years until I went to the National Archives and came across it. And it was an incredibly emotional moment for me to see what my father had written.
Had he ever talked about what he had written?
No, he didn't really talk much at all about that whole experience, that whole part of his life. He had survived it after 5 years of blacklisting. When we got to Madison, Wisconsin, and he started his long and distinguished career at the Madison Capital Times, he didn't look back and he didn't talk about it. It was a shadow of our lives. It wasn't that we didn't know about it. It just was something in the past. And so he never talked about the statement. The only reason I knew it might exist is because there was a transcript of the hearing, a public transcript, which I had read, and it shows him saying, I'd like to read a statement about what I think it means to be an American, and the chairman would not allow him to do that. So I wasn't really expecting to find it, but there it was when I opened up a file on the hearings in Detroit, specifically a file that was titled Elliot Marinus, and in that file of my father's was the statement.
When you started this book, what did you want to understand about your father and his choices that you didn't understand?
Well, my policy for any book I undertake is that I know nothing. In this case, you know, in other books, you know, biographies of Bill Clinton and Barack Obama and Vince Lombardi, they were strangers to me at the start and became very familiar to me after years of research. In this case, in one sense, my parents were intimately familiar to me at the beginning, and I was afraid that by the end they'd seem like strangers. That wasn't the case. I really came with a deeper appreciation of the struggles that they went through, of the thinking that led them in the ways that it did, how they recovered from that and recovered from the trauma of the blacklisting. And it also gave me a deeper understanding of myself, of my own sensibilities, why I am the way I am. My dad taught me to be open-minded, to to not fall for any rigid ideology, to search for the truth wherever it took me, to hate racism but not the racist. You know, that was part of his mantra. And all of that were the lessons that he learned from his own experiences.
Why now? Why was it important to you to dig into your family's story now?
Well, there are obviously echoes of today, but I started this story before the era of Donald Trump. I would say that why now for me was because I was in my 60s. I was, you know, a lot of people in that period of their life start looking back and wondering about the forces that shaped them. I'd done it with strangers before, and I realized it was time for me to figure out my own family and myself, and that's why I did it. And then the echoes started ringing, as they almost always do. So, you know, the central themes of this book are relevant today, maybe more relevant than ever, in terms of the manipulation of fear as a political weapon, the demonization of certain outsider groups, and that central question of what does it mean to be an American?
And do you have an answer to that for yourself?
Well, I have an answer that's different from the one that's being propagated today, absolutely, that there are a lot of different types of good American families, and my family certainly was one of those, and that this country is based on civil liberties, and that that's an essential part of this country's fabric, and those civil liberties have to be maintained above all else, and that America is nothing if it's not an open society.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking as I was reading the book that we are all a collection of contradictions. I mean, there isn't a person that has a straight line from one thing to the end of their life. You know, we all have a lot of things that make up who we are. And it's, you know, as we get older, I think it's reconciling all of that and trying to figure out, as you say, what it is that makes us who we are now.
That's a great point, Bonnie. And I think that's very true, that we, you know, all of us are a bundle of contradictions and competing forces, and there are certain through lines that go through our lives, and understanding those and how they shaped us and why we are what we are is what life is all about.
One of the things that struck me, and of course it would because of the profession that you and I are both in, is that your father didn't want to be called a journalist. He thought that was too highfalutin. That he liked newspaper man.
He liked reporter and newspaper man. You know, he loved Orwell and H.L. Mencken in various ways, and he had a strong feelings about the use of language and trying to make it as clear and clean as possible and not use any euphemisms. And maybe he thought journalist was a little too much of that sort. But, you know, I can live with the title, but, you know, he taught me, you know, call yourself a reporter.
Yeah, because that's really what if you're doing your job right, that's what you're doing.
Exactly.
And you're presenting it to people so that they can make up their minds.
Right. You're not writing a journal.
Right. Or a novel.
Although
I think sometimes it feels today like we're in some sort of dystopian science fiction thing.
That's for sure.
What do you think your father would have made of our times?
You know, my dad was an eternal optimist. That's one of the things that got him through all of his own troubles. And his motto tended to be, it could be worse. I think that related probably to what he had endured himself. I think that, you know, he died before Obama and before Trump. So I think he would have seen the promise and the despair of the American cycle of history.
Again, having finished the book, thinking, I would love to know what he would write about where we are now.
Yeah, I think that he would draw the comparisons with the past and see how we've learned from them and how we haven't, and probably strike an optimistic note about where we're going to end up.
Are you optimistic?
If we get through this. You know, he inculcated that into me. I would say that it's a stronger test of my optimism today than ever before in my life. My feeling is that the short term is iffy, the long term is better. So if we get through the short term, I'm fairly optimistic.
in a number of times, you know, and you've referenced it in this conversation about how he was determined to look forward. He was not going to dwell in the past. He was not going to be bitter about what happened to him. If there was something that you could ask him right now that he would answer, you know, and that you would hope he would answer, what would it be? Did you have questions that came up during the writing of this that you thought, I wish he was here, I could ask him about this?
Well, I would love to know what it was like during those few weeks, you know, when he was in the crucible. I can only imagine. And I don't know that he would tell me, but I would love to ask him those questions. You know, when you were writing your statement, what was that? What were the feelings that were going through you? Did you think you would survive it? Did you know you would? What, you know, how traumatic was it for you? And how did you maintain your optimism through all of the next 5 years?
For me, I thought it must have been terrifying to sit in there knowing that the full force of your own government was against you.
Yeah, that's the thing. That, you know, there's different levels of power, and to face the power of government, that its ability to disrupt and destroy lives is frightening, and he had to deal with that.
When you're talking to people about this, and you're going to be doing that here in Milwaukee for the, the library, what do you want people to take away from the book, other than knowing more about you and your family and this particular set of circumstances? Is there a greater theme that you want people to be thinking about?
Oh, there absolutely is, and that's the importance of civil liberties as the foundation of the American democracy. And I end my speech reading my father's statement because it went unread. And now, as his son, I'm able to read it to the world. And it's an incredibly powerful statement. And I think when people hear that, they'll go away hearing enough of what I have to say.
Would you mind reading some of it for us?
I will. I was taught as a child and in school that the highest responsibility of citizenship is to defend the principles of the U.S. Constitution and to do my part in securing for the American people the blessings of peace, economic well-being, and freedom. I have tried to do that to the very best of my ability. And for doing just that and nothing more, I have been summarily discharged from my job. I have been blacklisted in the newspaper business after 12 years in which my competence and objectivity have never once been questioned. I must sell my home, uproot my family, and upset the tranquility and security of my three small children in the happy formative years of their childhood. But I would rather have my children miss a meal or two now than have them grow up in the gruesome, fear-ridden future for America projected by members of the House Committee on Un-American Activity. I don't like to talk about these things, but my Americanism has been questioned, and to properly measure a man's Americanism, he must know the whole pattern of a life. The U.S. Constitution and its Bill of Rights are not simply musty documents in a library. They have meaning only if they are used. To betray and subvert the Bill of Rights is the most un-American act any man or committee can do. For that document was brought into being and maintained throughout our history by men who gave their blood and their lives and blood. That's what makes this committee so dangerous. Ostensibly designed to protect the government against overthrow by force and violence, it proceeds by force, terror, and threats to overthrow the rights of the American people. The committee reflects no credit on American institutions or ideas. Its attempt to enforce conformity of political or economic thought is a long step toward dictatorship that holds the greatest danger to the American people. In this country, we have never acquiesced in the proposition that people could be punished for their beliefs.
Pulitzer Prize winner David Marinus is an editor at the Washington Post and the author of numerous best-selling books. His most recent is called A Good American Family, The Red Scare, and My Father. He spoke with Lake Effect's Bonnie North in May. We'll take a short break now, and then when we return, we'll chat with the Wisconsin Humane Society about how to protect your pets and other animals when the weather gets chilly. Lake Effect returns in just a moment on WUWM.
Thank you.
hour of Lake Effect Now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. The intense cold this season has been unusual, and many people are feeling the effects. But the cold also has a profound effect on other animals, both wild and domestic. So how can we safeguard our pets and the other animals in our lives? Ann Reed is the president and CEO of the Wisconsin Humane Society, and Crystal Charlo Schaefer is a member of the organization's wildlife rehab team. They joined Lake Effect's Bonnie North last January, and Reed explains that the best thing to do for our pets in the extreme cold is to keep them inside.
It's by far the biggest thing. There are lots of other things that we can talk about, but the biggest thing is to, no matter what your dog tells you in terms of exercise, keep that being outside long enough to go to the bathroom and right back in. No matter what your cat tells you about how much they like to be outdoors, indoors is the place for a cat to be. It's just as it's actively dangerous for humans, it's actively dangerous for them to be outdoors. So we're
so
inside.
So anyone who might have like an outside doghouse, don't use it.
Don't. It's absolutely too cold by far. You know, I'm smiling a little because today, as we're taping this, today's the warm day. It's up to 3 degrees and it's all of minus 19 in wind chill. And that obviously feels very cold to us. Wednesday and Thursday are going to be interplanetary cold. Any arrangements you have made for your animal to be safe outdoors in cold weather, you didn't make them for weather like this. Indoors is the place for your animal to be.
So, Crystal, for people who might have chickens, say, mm-hmm. in their backyards, because that's something that people can have urban, not really farms, but animals that don't normally come inside, they're not normally pets. What do you do?
So for chicken coops, hopefully when you built or designed your chicken coop, you had winter weather in mind, meaning that it's insulated, it's protected from drafts and things like that. Now, anticipating this cold weather, if at all possible, insulate it even more, use appropriate bedding. You can also offer supplemental heat by using a heat lamp. Just be really careful that you don't have any bedding touch that lamp. Those lamps are very hot. It's also important that they have access to fresh water. So you can get electric heated dog bowls, and I know chickens are going to step in that, so make sure that's clean and change it regularly. But that's something you have to take into consideration when you have a little group of chickens, is that they will definitely be affected by the weather.
Is there thought that maybe even putting something over the top of the coop, like, you know, the idea of putting a quilt even or some kind of something over to help with insulation temporarily when it's this bitterly cold?
Yeah, I don't know the effectiveness of just a quilt. Certainly it will do some degree. Frequently people will use large straw bales and brace those against the outsides of their coops. But this is something to consider as well, especially with more municipalities approving urban chickens. Take winter weather into consideration when designing your coop for the future.
So, Anne, despite your best efforts, say your dog goes out longer than it should have and comes in with frozen paws. Mm-hmm. What do you do?
You're calling the vet. So for frostbite, you're looking for discoloration, especially on the skin. You're looking for blisters and swelling. Your animal obviously has ways of letting you know they're in pain. For hypothermia, you're looking for shivering and trembling. You're looking for lethargy. Is your animal cold to the touch? Some things might look a little neurological, like trouble walking. If you're concerned, you're calling your vet. You're getting in there. We expect that emergency vets will be getting a lot of calls during this time. So those are the things you're looking for.
What can you do between the time you notice your pet not behaving correctly and getting it to the vet? I mean, is it good to wrap them in warm towels and that sort of thing?
Best thing is definitely to wrap in a blanket. For frostbite, we're advising don't immerse in hot water. Don't rub. That skin is quite delicate. But wrapping in a warm blanket on your way to the vet and getting over there is the thing to do.
So paws obviously are the thing that's most affected. What about things like noses and tails?
Yep, and ears.
Ears.
Now, paws are protectable. If your dog will wear those boots, they're great. And we also recommend just something like Vaseline, some other sort of thing to put on those paws. And this actually brings up another point that Crystal and I were actually talking about this morning, which is the things that are hard right now to do, like, oh, my dog doesn't want to put on those boots, or, oh, my dog won't go to the bathroom outside, which we have another the tip for, or my cat just won't want to stay in. just say, all right, I'm caught up short this time. I'm going to have a rough couple of days managing this. I'm going to now start the things that are going to make this easier the next time. So we're going to start little pieces of hot dog and boots when you don't need them so that it'll be easier the next time.
So talk about the going to the bathroom.
Yeah,
so how do you get that to happen? Because obviously they need to.
A friend of mine posted on Facebook last night a picture of the track her dog had made through a foot of snow to get, not in the way they had shoveled for that dog, but that dog wanted to go to a specific spot. It was really funny, like a little tunnel. One kind of call we get a lot is dogs just don't want to go to the bathroom on the snow. And one trick that we're finding that's really helpful for people is to get hold of some hay at your farm supply store, or maybe your neighbor has some, and spread that out. Shovel a space and spread that out so you have a little non-snow spot outside your house. And that's been helpful for a lot of people.
Well, also the hay, I think, would protect for the cold, too. It makes them want to stand there long enough to actually defecate.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's a little bit warmer.
Any other tips that we should be giving pet owners?
You know, ID tags and chip are, and it's, you know, too late to get the chip for tomorrow, but making sure that your animals are wearing tags so that if they do get out and somebody sees them, they can act quickly. Never leave an animal in the car is a big one. Same thing in the summer. That's a lot less safe than we think it is. And one tip we're giving out a lot is before you start your car, a wild animal or a cat might be in there somewhere to seek warmth. So honk the horn, bang on the hood, exactly,
yeah.
and be sure you're not hurting an animal who's in there.
So, Crystal, speaking of wildlife, and that's where you work with the Wisconsin Humane Society, what if somebody finds an animal in their backyard that is a wild animal but is obviously stressed or frozen? What do you do?
Yeah, well, we are there. We're here at the Wisconsin Humane Society Wildlife Rehabilitation Center 365 days a year. So certainly you can call us. We always want to counsel you first. We also have information on our website about what to do, because each different species is going to have different things to do for safety, for human safety, for animal safety. But if you find an animal that you believe may be sick or injured, call us. Definitely call us. We are there. That's what we're there for.
So don't try to intervene on your own without calling you first.
We always like you to call us first, and then we can direct you just for human safety and for animal safety.
The rabbits and foxes and birds are all going to be affected by this extreme cold as well.
And all in different ways. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, all I can say is, ladies, thank you so much. Stay warm next couple of days, and I really appreciate you coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Ann Reed is the president and CEO of the Wisconsin Humane Society. Crystal Charlotte Schaefer is a member of the organization's wildlife rehab team. They spoke with Lake Effects Bonnie North last January, and you can find more of our cold weather coverage at WUWM.com. Coming up, we'll learn the history of the 125-mile route known as the Oak Leaf Trail. Lake Effect continues in just a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. More of Lake Effect Now, I'm Joy Powers. If you live in Milwaukee, chances are that you're within 3 miles of the Oak Leaf Trail. The city is just one of 7 metropolitan areas where more than 90% of its residents live within close access to the Oak Leaf. Writer Matthew Prigge discussed the history of this 125-mile trail in a feature in Milwaukee Magazine titled A Grand Old Leaf. Prigge joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in June to share what he learned about the Oak Leaf's past, its present, and what it hopes to become in its future. He begins by explaining what led to the first test ride of the trail in 1939.
The earliest inklings of this were kind of based in this hostile movement that was, it had become popular in Germany in the early 1900s. It was basically these series of little, you know, campsites or hotels along these trails that hikers and backpackers would use as they traversed the German countryside. And that had come to the U.S. by the 19, 20s, around that era. And the idea was to kind of create this series of these hostels in eastern Wisconsin. And that never really took hold. But the idea of having these expansive trails that would have gone along with those did. And that was the sort of the brainchild of one of the early bicycling advocates here in the area named Zip Morgan, who eventually laid out what became the Oak Leaf Trail as a bicycle and hiking trail that was sort of based on the same idea of getting out to nature and to getting away from the city without really being all that far from the city. But it ended up manifesting itself as this trail around Milwaukee County.
Cycling really took off after the Great Depression, right? So that contributed to people's want and the popularity of just getting around by bike?
Yeah, there was a cycling fad in the late 1800s that had sort of faded away by the 20s. But with the Depression, with you know, resources scarce, with people looking to save money any way they could, a lot of people turned back to cycling as a more practical means of getting around rather than the earlier incantation of this being sort of a, I don't want to say frivolous, but, you know, a recreational
right.
thing. So the idea was to use this as a way to get around, and the popularity in cycling led to the establishment of this round the county trail.
So we have Harold Zip Morgan, and we also have a man named Sam Snead. So what was Sam's influence with all of this as well?
I believe he's the one that actually charted that came up with the route that they would take back in June 1939. Snead and Morgan and a group of some other local cycling activists and even a reporter from, I think it was the Milwaukee Journal, took the initial ride on the Oak Leaf, which was at that time just basically, you know, going through some city streets, but mostly dirt paths or trails through county parks. So Snead was the one that came up with this idea. This was also kind of derived from the idea of the county parks in general, that they would create this ring around the county of green space. Now, that never became as complete as Charles Whitnall, the father of the county parks, here wanted it to be. But it left a good, you know, a very good starting point for where they eventually mapped this trail.
So they were mapping the trail based on existing green spaces that were already there, or were they constructing new paths as well?
No, the green spaces were already there. I can't remember specifically. I mentioned it in the article, but they did something, you know, the 70-mile loop, all of it, but maybe 10 or so miles was on, you know, off of the thoroughfares and the streets. So they got to do a large portion of it through these parks. But that initial ride, again, back in 39 would have been a pretty tough, I mean, even today going, you know,
yeah,
the loop around the Oak Leaf would be quite a bit. But back then, obviously, riding, you know, bicycles from a different era. They were pretty much going on, you know, on dirt and, you know, at best on gravel in places.
Mm-hmm. So they are making this initial ride in 1939, but the Oak Leaf Trail, as we know it, wasn't officially recognized until 1965. So why do you think it took so long to have that, you know, official recognition and the complete connectivity?
Yeah, well, you know, cycling, even though it was as popular as it got in the 30s, it was still sort of, you know, I don't think the government or the county government or the county parks really recognized it as something that needed to be. I'm not sure they saw a lot of value in catering to this sect of the population, but cyclists certainly knew about it. And, you know, there's evidence sort of anecdotally that people had been using this loop that was created through this time. But, yeah, it wasn't until the late 60s that the county finally paved a small portion of it in Lake Park. You know, even when they just had a few miles of it, it was sort of considered this very forward thing among the cycling community nationwide that Milwaukee was doing this. And once they started to pave things, this idea that Milwaukee could become a national cycling hub kind of took off. And, you know, from that, just in bits and pieces, they managed to complete the rest of the loop.
And we've continued to have new paving segments done today, mm-hmm. or maintenance done. And you mentioned that Milwaukee was set to be this bicycling hub. And recently, we moved up to the third highest level by the League of American Bicyclists. We're a silver level for bike safety, accessibility, things like that.
Yeah.
But we're still not there. You know, we're still not that bicycling
right.
hub that was projected to be. So how do you think the Oak Leaf can help or hinder that? And where do we rank compared to other major cities? Do they have a similar system like we have the Oak Leaf?
Yeah, well, in talking to the people from the parks, it's certainly, unique thing nationally to have so much of the population within such a close distance of this huge trail that is going to, you can take this 40 miles to the north. You can connect it to the Waukesha trails. That's certainly unique in that regard, that this huge portion of the population has pretty good access to this. And I think it just starts or just lays down, there's so much here for bike cyclists just existing. And I think it's a lot easier to build off of that when you have something like the Oak Leaf that so many people use and I use it to commute to work. Lots of people use it to commute to work. It's not strictly a recreational thing. It's a very practical means of getting around and of not needing to use a car. And as that picks up, and certainly it has in recent years, I think that just makes adapting more for cyclists just that much easier here in the city. I just saw, recently in the last couple of days, I saw that they're adding something like 4,000 new bike racks. You can line your bikes up to all over the city. So that's just just to point out, stopping here to do this interview, I needed to lock my bike to a parking meter because there wasn't one in close proximity. So that's certainly a great thing that that they're adapting here. And I'm not sure if we don't have the Oak Leaf in this great base of recreational and commuter cycling, I'm not sure that that's as easy to get past.
Exactly. There's also the importance and practicality of the rails to trails here, whether it was Oak Leaf or, the upcoming Ride of the Badger. And the Oak Leaf had the iteration of the 76 trail in particular. Can you explain that a little bit?
Well, the 76 trail was sort of the first, bringing that original, the Morgan and Snead trail up to, what we know it as today. And that was inaugurated in 1976 for the bicentennial. So it had that, the patriotic motivation behind it as well. It was also said to be 76 miles, the total trail length, but that was always just kind of a misnomer, I think. That just worked out well, so
sure.
That's what they called it. But yeah, the Oak Leaf was known as the 76 Trail up until 1996, but that was the first, the unification of all this, if you want to use that word.
So the one major part of the city that the Oak Leaf, longs to be connected to and from and has long been debated is the Hone connection, somehow getting cyclists over the Hone.
Yeah.
And people can do that for the Ride for the Arts when they shut it down.
Right.
But due to various safety concerns, funding reasons, that hasn't happened. Are there any other major gaps that people in Milwaukee County would like to see connected? Or is the Hone still a point of, not necessarily contention, but still a want for
the
county?
Yeah, that's the big one. I mean, that makes it getting from the lakefront part of the trail that runs past the Art Museum and Discovery World.
Because usually you'd maybe take the Kinnickinnick River Parkway and then go downtown and some streets and pick it back up
at the
lakefront.
It's not difficult to get around that. I mean, I've done that before, going down to even just to Bayview. But, there's a kind of a run in Bayview where you're on the streets and there are bike paths, so it's not, it's very doable. But yeah, the Hone would be the one thing that would, it would serve the same purpose that the Hone Bridge does for automobiles. It's a much easier way to get from, the downtown to that part of the city. But they've had a few opportunities to get that done. There doesn't really seem to be the political will on the part of the state to do that. I'd love to see it happen, but I'm not going to hold my breath on that.
Right. And obviously safety is a concern with that one. But overall on the trail, is safety still a concern? Do you think it's improved as the trail has gotten wider? I mean, it's still a mixed-use trail, so people do need to be conscious of where
they're going. There seem to be a lot of the people I talked to who have been riding the trail for, since it was the 76 and, even prior to that, there was sort of this perception that it was unsafe. I'm not sure if any of that really was, if that was really based in reality or not, but, it is an out-of-the-way part of the city, and I think people's just opinions of safety in the city have changed quite a bit since that time as well. But, as far as I know, there's no major safety concerns today. Obviously, let people know when you're passing it and wear a helmet and be safe as you can when you're riding or running. But, I've been riding running the Oak Leaf Trail for years now, and it's the incredible thing to me is that you can be so close to everything yet just feel very removed and like you're in a state park somewhere up north. But yeah, it's just this incredible asset to have so close to everything.
And it's a big factor in community engagement. So how are businesses, communities utilizing the trail to set up shop or perhaps encourage further engagement, like, for example, the Urban Ecology Center right off the Oak Leaf Trail?
Yeah, the thing that really comes to mind there is the Urban Ecology Center on the east side, because they are right on the trail. They have a ramp or an access point from their location right down to the trail. And that was I talked to some people there, and a big part of getting that to happen was the trail to have such close access to everything, and to getting that area there in Riverside Park cleaned up, to have the trail there as a means of getting that done. Because without that, that's really this. Without the trail here, that's really an out of the way part of the city that nobody would really think to ever go. But it's a great catalyst for things all along the trail. And of course, connecting the county parks. We have beer gardens now, and you can even use it to get out to the Three Bridges Park out near the stadium, which is I've been out there, going out there as often as I can, and that's just another incredible part of the city where you feel so removed from everything, but you can literally still see the downtown skyline and the Urban Ecology Center that's out there as well. So it's just, it's a great point to help things develop and just to, to continue this, the trend that the city seems to be on of appreciating these areas.
What's next for the Oak Leaf?
Well, they are doing connecting to the Badger Link? Route of the Badger, yeah, which is pretty ambitious project that's going to, with some additional trails and linkages, to make this something that you can, from the Oak Leaf, all these other access points to these other local trails. So, yeah, really just as, you can soon, you'll be able to take this as pretty much as far as most people will be able to pedal.
You mentioned that you take it to commute to work, mm-hmm. amongst recreation, other things. Before digging into this story, do you now have a newfound appreciation for the pavements you're hitting every day?
I do. Even before I started this, I really didn't know. I mean, I used my portion of the trail to get to where I needed to go, but I didn't realize how expansive it was and just how much this was such a part of just this vision for the city, starting back in the 1800s with this ring of county parks, and that this was really something to serve the citizenry here. And it was just the modern culmination of this long-standing idea of how a city should engage with its natural areas.
Well, Matthew Priggy, thanks for your work and your insight on the Oak Leaf. I hope people can appreciate it more and get out on it.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. Always a pleasure.
Matthew Priggy is a local writer whose feature on the Oak Leaf Trail was published in Milwaukee Magazine. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in June, and you can find more at WUWM.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.